Hey everyone, back again. Today we're going to cover John Locke's second treatise of government, which you can read on its own. You don't need to have read the first treatise, but if you want to, you know, you can go and read it, or you can listen to the episode I've done on it. You know, your heart will guide you in the direction that it should go. But before jumping into it, hi, I'm David. I explain philosophical concepts and ideas and texts in ways to make them accessible to you. So if you're new here, you can like, share, subscribe. You can see videos I release every single week, sometimes twice a week. You can follow me on any other platform, links in the description. You can help me out by doing all those things I just mentioned, liking, sharing, subscribing, or monetarily via Patreon or PayPal, but no pressure to do that. If you found this on YouTube, you're going to be able to find it as a podcast on pretty much any podcast platform. Or if you found this as a podcast, you're going to be able to find it on YouTube, or sometimes there's a video. Isn't that fun? So yeah, let's jump into John Locke's second treatise of government, which is titled or subtitled Concerning the True Original Extent and End of Civil Government. Now, this belongs to the broader trajectory or the broader field of social contract theory. Now, in short, social contract theory suggests that when humans enter into society, they do so not because anyone sat them down and was like, okay, here are the rules of society, but instead it is a more tacit, unwritten acknowledgement that to enter society means that you give up some basic liberties to live in peace and freedom and to be protected by the state. And John Locke really belongs to this tradition, from Hobbes to Locke and then Rousseau. These are all very important thinkers for this conversation. And John Locke has a very specific way of looking at this entrance into society, into a commonwealth, which he elucidates in a lot of detail, and a lot of interesting detail here. But he begins by his second treatise by recounting some of the main points from the first one. And if you want more on this, go and listen to all I've done on the first treatise. But he essentially recounts here his criticisms of Filmer. So for those of you who don't have the time or inclination to go and listen to the first episode or episode on the first treatise, essentially what John Locke does there is present Filmer's arguments. And Filmer's argument was that humans are almost predisposed to submitting to sovereign authority. That is, humans are designed to be submissive to authority, which John Locke does not believe at all. But by way of evidence, Filmer points to the Bible, and Filmer's like, look, in the Bible, there are kings, God essentially rules humanity, we have to rule our children, and so as you are born, you're born into rule. You are designed to be then ruled by society. So John Locke's main criticisms of Filmer's arguments are that Adam's authority, Adam from the Bible, wasn't over his children. That is, God did not command that Adam have dominion over his children, but dominion over the world, per se. His children also didn't inherit Adam's power, if he had any. Instead, it would be passed on to others. If they had, though, if the children had, Adam's children had acquired this power, there'd be no way to know which child would be the ruler, because Adam had a few kids. Then finally, if we follow along Filmer's line of argument, that is, there's the original sovereign, God, and then there's Adam, and Adam's descendants then become the new sovereign each time, which is already, like, what an argument, but this guy tried to make it. That would imply then that we are all rulers, because we're all Adam's descendants, according to the Bible. So John Locke, to be kind of mean to John Locke, is really going after the low-hanging fruit here, because his main point is to resist the idea that humans are predisposed to be subordinate. They're designed to be subordinate to authority. So to do this, he presents like Filmer, who is like extremely pro-monarchy, extremely pro, he believed very firmly in the divine right of kings, that kings, you know, have been given their power by God, and therefore they shouldn't be challenged or anything. And like, these ideas, of course, were popular at the time, But I think that John Locke would have set himself up against a much more interesting foe if he'd looked at, like, Hobbes, who makes somewhat similar arguments about the need for sovereignty, but in a much more nuanced way, where many of the problems with Filmer is that it's just, like, it's just an absurd argument that, you know, we have our first sovereign with God, and then every descendant becomes this new sovereign, when it's just historically so far from the truth that it makes it almost comical to deal with. And it's funny, too, if you read the first treatise, John Locke is a funny dude. He was just making fun of Filmer and how it's incomprehensible and all that. But in any case, you know, this is what we have. This is what John Locke chose to treat as his primary enemy to then offer his rebuttal, his idea of how states work. So for him, Locke believes that political power is different from paternal, so the power of parents over children, or patriarchal power of like a father over his family. And it is different as well. Political power is different from the rule that lords might have over their servants, or captains over their sailors, or any other, you know, managerial type position in industry. He says that this political power is an entirely different beast, and it's wrong to extrapolate from these other jobs, or how these other jobs tend to have a leader type roles, to extrapolate from that, then therefore there must be like a ruler of society that everybody has to follow the rules of. So how does Locke define political power? Well, for him, political power in the Commonwealth is the ability to make laws with penalties of death, to protect property, and defend the Commonwealth from foreign threats, all for the public good. These are the primary defining qualities or propensities of those in political power. So if you're, you know, if you're paying attention, you might think, okay, so one of the defining qualities then of a sovereign, of someone in high political power, is that they exist above the law because they're creating laws. They exist in this kind of, they transcend laws. That is, they're able to decide who gets to live, who gets to die. They create laws that determine life and death. Like, that's not something everyone has the ability to contribute to. Or I should say, is permitted to contribute to. We, you know, we can't decide laws amongst ourselves about, you know, deciding who gets to live and who gets to die. If people did that, then they would be arrested, the state would come in and tell them not to. So John Locke is already prepared to acknowledge that political power is power that is not exercised among the general public. So there's something transcendent about it. Not in a highfalutin metaphysical way, but just it exists above the social body. And that puts us here into chapter 2 of The State of Nature, which is where we're going to get some very important distinctions from Thomas Hobbes's view, from Leviathan. And if you're interested in that, you can go and see the episodes I've done on Thomas Hobbes. But John Locke presents a very different idea about the state of nature or the state of war. So for Locke, political power originates in the state of nature. That is because the state of nature is the first site for the exercise of any kind of power. Now, the difference, because Thomas Hobbes agrees to the same thing, the difference for Locke here is that he believes in the state of nature, people are guided by nature's, and therefore God's, laws. And some of these laws would include that people struggle for their own self-preservation, and they do so without hurting others, because they know, and humans know instinctively, for Locke, that the best way to live is among others and cooperatively. So the state of nature is a state where all people are equal and who operate in accordance with nature's laws. And in this state, people are inclined to be kind towards others out of fear they might suffer retaliation if they do not. act kindly. Whereas for Hobbes is like, in the state of nature, it's pure chaos, unlimited liberty. You can do whatever you want. You're opening yourself up to certain risks, but you can do whatever you want, and it's pure anarchy. There's no like real possibility for power, or if it is, it's purely individual, yada yada yada. Locke has a lot more faith in the state of nature than Hobbes. So nature's laws for Locke work in such a way as to punish people in the state of nature who transgress or who break those laws. That if someone breaks a law, they open themselves up to punishment. And in response, people may act as nature's executioner. So if you do something wrong, other people are just going to harm you for it. And this, for Locke, is a sign of nature's law at work. Even though these instances would likely be pretty rare, really not that often for Locke, because for the most part, people would be guided by a desire to keep things in a harmonious equilibrium. So there's a kind of order within the state of nature, and I don't think it's a totally radical idea. That is, one of European colonialism's justifications was that they would be civilizing people who they encountered outside of Europe in the quote-unquote New World, an already discovered world with people in it, but in the European imagination it was this New World. And the people there were framed as being uncivilized, chaotic, anarchic, when in fact they were anything but the sort. They were living in these very complicated state systems and other kinds of community organizations that were not even recognized. And so in those moments, you see an interesting application of this idea of the state of nature to degrade and dehumanize others. Now, those people did not fall into the state of nature as John Locke is talking about here. John Locke is talking about, like, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago while people were still like nomadic hunters and gatherers. But this idea is nevertheless applied to people who just don't subscribe to European ideals of how to organize government or communities. And he too falls into this by suggesting that indigenous populations in what is now colonial Canada or colonial United States, these places were essentially justified in forming because the people there were uncivilized. They weren't actually taking advantage of the land and of political government. So exactly what John Locke means by the state of nature is a little bit ambiguous. You know, is he referring to this like first humans, hunters and gatherers, you know, people living largely on their own in very tiny, tiny communities, just trying to survive hand to mouth? Is he talking about people who just have not adopted the European idea about how politics should be organized, how people should be organized, and so on? Difficult to say. But in any case, what is beyond the shadow of a doubt are the problematic ways in which this idea has been applied to degrade and dehumanize certain people. But in any case, he believes that in the state of nature, as I was saying before, there are these laws, there are these orders that should be followed. So he provides the example where people have a right to kill a murderer for the risk that that murderer poses to humankind. And so in this case, he suggests that the murderer is like an animal, in that they are unable to actually integrate with society and pose a greater threat to society than a non-murderer. So they are therefore justified in being killed. Now, when he uses this example, though, and it's difficult, he's talking about the state of nature, but he appeals to society to be like, these people who commit murder can't fit in with nature because they can't fit in with a society. And we're like, wait, I thought we were talking about the state of nature here. What do you mean society? But there are lots of these little points where, you know, contradictions emerge. But in any case, that's what he says. Now, with all of this, he gives room to problematize or interrogate the idea that the state of nature simply comes before society, where he says that the state of nature is also kind of found within all of us, and it can always rear its head, even in the most, in his eyes, advanced state formations. And he uses the example of when aristocrats or tyrants are feuding among themselves and casting people into war. He's like that, you know, even in these very advanced state formations, we see the state of nature reemerge and it pushes people into a state of war. So in that case, you know, the state of nature is a very ambiguous term. It mostly refers to what comes before the state, but can be found in the state when people do not act according to nature's laws, nature's order. Now, against Locke, a number of other people, Thomas Hobbes included, believe that the state of nature is pure chaos, pure anarchy, no rules, anything like that, and that people have to be persuaded and eventually consent to giving up their liberties to enter into a society. And the reason for that, at least for Hobbes, is that having people submit to authority makes it a lot easier for people to actually understand and follow rules, because there's only one person giving the rules. They might have some judges who adjudicate issues dealing with the rules and laws, and it just simplifies things. Whereas in the state of nature, everyone acts as their own judge, and so you can't have agreements between things. But against these ideas, John Locke says, is it really better to have people submit to a potential tyrant in a dictatorship? Is that really better than having people be out in nature, the state of nature, where they're their own judges acting according to their own wills? John Locke believes that that would be better than just mindlessly submitting to authority, as Hobbes advocates. And that puts us here into chapter 3, the state of war. So for Locke, the state of war refers to a moment when someone or something threatens another, prompting a retaliation. And so there's a battle that's going to ensue. So to open a state of war is to threaten to take away another's liberty before their life. As such, Locke justifies murdering a thief, which is wild, murdering a thief because he has no reason to think that, in his words, in Locke's words, he who would take away my liberty would not, when he had me in his power, take away everything else. So what Locke is saying here is that if I have reason to believe, or if someone stole from me, I am therefore justified in believing that they're willing to kill me. Where to commit murder is the necessary or a likely follow-up to thievery. And while it might seem like a big leap, and indeed it is, and is something that I don't think anyone would really subscribe to or believe today, the point that he's making, to be generous to Locke, is that life goes hand in hand with liberty, where for him to be free and to be free from harm is really like the only thing worth living for. And if you don't have that, he's like, why bother living at all? So for him, because he holds liberty up to such a high level, he can say, or he justifies to himself, that somebody willing to threaten that liberty by infringing upon my rights, by stealing from me, is then capable and potentially willing to take away my life, because to have already infringed upon my liberty is almost as bad for Locke already. So there are situations then in society where people are going to be forced into a state of war, where for Locke, in this imagined scenario, someone breaks into Locke's house. He takes this as an invitation to murder them out of self-defense, where even in a situation where it might be clear that the person is not interested in physically hurting John Locke, in any case, John Locke sees that it is justified for him to murder the thief. And in that moment, when one's life has been called into question, or it has been threatened, or one's liberty, which is pretty much the same thing for Locke, then people have entered into a state of war, even if they exist in a society. And that is because the law is not omnipresent. It's not always around. There aren't always police you can scream to for help. Then, you know, do police really help? And but in any case, he believes that there are moments when people are going to need to revert to the state of war in order to defend themselves. And I think it's really interesting. I'd be curious what people have to say about this, is just how much John Locke's ideas influenced the American Constitution and American laws, because a lot of it goes hand in hand. They're very close bedfellows, that John Locke and the framers of the Constitution, or at least they're drawing from many of the same ideas. And that puts us into chapter 4 of slavery. So given all this, slavery exists in the state of war, where someone's liberty and life has been taken from them and is owned by and commanded by somebody else, hence an enslaved person and an enslaver. Now, enslavement can only arise when a state of war has been acted upon. And that is because for Locke, nobody can actually give up their liberties by consent. No one can consent to giving up liberty, because it would require you not to already have liberty to then give up that liberty, or you are demonstrating that you have liberty in choosing. But he just appeals to humans' desire for self-preservation to say that no one would want to be enslaved. So the very existence of enslavement is a sign of something that he's not fond of, and that is the state of war. The state of war had to have been in force, it had to have been exercised to produce the conditions for somebody to be enslaved, which is true even of course, in cases of war, where prisoners of war are taken and then forced into enslavement. Like, this is still a sign of there having been war, where people were feuding about something, which is, to be honest, his view about is kind of ambiguous. Like, is he criticizing this? Is he saying, well, there's some cases where this needs to happen? Tricky to know. I kind of think he's critical of it, and that should become more clear as we consider his views on liberty. But that puts us here into chapter 5 of property. So in addition to life and liberty, he adds a third thing that's of the utmost importance to human self-realization, and that is property. So in terms of property, Locke is clear that no one has a divine right to anything on the earth, any property, but we are all open to all the world has to offer. So for Locke, and it's interesting what parts of Locke's ideas are really adopted by the American right, and which ones are very conveniently ignored. You know, because those right-wing ding-dongs online who like to scream about how they're classic liberals or something, and they point to John Locke, or they throw his name, Mill, and others, to say that, liberals were once reasonable or something, like as though there's any real connection between a liberal today and this kind of liberal. But in any case, it's interesting to see what parts of this so-called classic liberal identity they hold on to and which ones they criticize. Because for Locke, no like publicly accessible piece of land should be just owned by somebody, that is someone who's never actually been there or acted upon it. He's like totally opposed to that. The only true thing for Locke that we have unmitigated power over and the right over is really our own body. Now, in cases where you use your body for labor power, and you work upon the land, like to make a cornfield, for example, he says in such a case there, so long as you're working on that land and the fruits of your labor are yours. So it would be thievery then if someone came and stole your corn. So no one owns water. Like for Locke, no one should ever own a body of water or a river. However, if I take a bucket and put it in the water and then I'm walking away with it and someone steals that bucket from me, they've stolen from me. And the reason for that for Locke is because I have used my labor to procure, to acquire this object from the earth. So therefore, thievery is infringing upon the labor that was once committed to something to then acquire something else. So in that way, this is why he takes thievery so seriously, at least in part, is that it undermines people's attachment to themselves and the world as they have cultivated their own space, their own identity, the world around them through their labor. Thievery comes in and disturbs that. It's not just about taking something that somebody owns, but taking away their very connection to the world. So this applies too in cases where you might hire someone to perform a job for you. You know, you enter into a contract or covenant that makes it so that person owes you something by the labor they've done, and you will pay them for it, which is kind of how the entire capitalist economy works. And it's interesting to see how, or it's interesting to ponder, I think, how these ideas dovetail with the capitalist economy, because really one of the defining characteristics of capitalism is that it has to underpay workers. Because if it didn't, people wouldn't make profit. And so, you know, the example I like to give is like, I work at McDonald's for $10 an hour or whatever I work for. Am I earning the company $10 an hour? No, I'm probably earning them 50, 75, $100 an hour, whatever amount I'm earning them. And so in that case, my value is whatever I've earned the company, but I'm only being paid the $10. Now, take this example and ask yourself, what would happen to you if you walked into a store and you went up to the cashier and you said, "Oh, I see that this loaf of bread is worth $5, but I think it's actually just worth $2, so I'm gonna give you two for it." They'll laugh you out of the store. So capitalism then, as an economic system, is a system that is predicated upon the direct, immediate exploitation of people, of thievery of people. So in the context of Locke's argument, would he see this as thievery that, you know, is justifiably wrong and that people are justified in opposing, like even as far as murder, for example, because that is what he says, or when it if it is conducted in such a way where it is the entire bedrock of the economic system people are in, does the brand of thievery go away, or can it not be recognized then as thievery? So in what way are laws around thievery designed not to actually protect people from thievery, but are actually designed to protect a certain class of people from a certain kind of thievery, where thievery laws don't apply to landowners or to capitalists who underpay their workers, but a thievery law would apply to me if I underpaid for a loaf of bread at the local supermarket. So, like, how in that case does thievery, you know, how do we make sense of it there? I'd be curious what anyone has to say about it. Where the easy answer is just like, which I don't know if I'm totally satisfied with the answer, but like from other thinkers, they say that it's just because the capitalist mode of production is just so dominant, it allows us to live in these kind of hypocritical, contradictory realities where we just accept wide-scale thievery, theft, murder, destroying resources, while at the same time seeing individual acts of these things as being like the ultimate evils. So with all of this, the kind of meta point I'm trying to make is that John Locke was just seeing the world he was living in and then extrapolating from that world this apparent universal knowledge about what it means to be a human and what it means to have liberty and what it means to have property. Where when he gives the example of somebody reaching in the water grabbing a pail, or with a pail to grab water, and he's using this to imagine, a world in which that water is exclusively the pail holder's water, I think that we have to be very wary about the kind of world that he's describing. It sounds a lot more like 17th and 18th century Europe than it does a more communal society where a community actually looks after one another, where for many communities throughout the world for much of human history, there'd be no question about the individual ownership of water that's been taken from a river. It would just be for everybody. Because how much water do you really need as one person with like a pail coming from the river? But in any case, it's just important to acknowledge how John Locke uses and deploys ideas of the natural order of things or natural law in order to provide some kind of universal idea about human conduct, which has nothing to do with nature and nothing to do with all humans, but is actually reflecting, it actually reflects a very specific moment in time, really in European history. Now he adds to this a kind of thought experiment where he's like, he imagines if someone said, okay, well, if I am the rightful owner of anything I've procured through my own labor, does that mean that I can just run around and like collect all the apples off all the trees, hypothetically, and then they'd all be mine? And John Locke's answer, because it's a very good question, John Locke's answer to this is like, no, and why would you want to do that? Because they'd spoil. You wouldn't be able to eat all the apples. So for him, people will limit themselves according to quote-unquote reason, which is interesting because we find a very similar argument in Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, where Adam Smith for one moment in that text is kind of reflectively being like, I wonder like if the capitalist system might actually be deleterious to humanity because people might just try to acquire as much as they possibly can, and it'll lead to monopolies, it'll lead to scarcity where others can't have things. And Adam Smith says, like, he's like, no one would ever want like more than one pot to do their dishes or to cook with. Like, people are guided by their reason in that they just acquire the thing they need and then that's it. And it's like, my guy, the lack of foresight or just the refusal to look at your own world and see already how in the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe, resources were starting to be hoarded by certain families, certain groups of people. It's just amazing that they think this. And John Locke makes a similar case that, oh, well, people will just be limited by reason. And we have to confront, like, the nature of the capitalist economy in that it's not guided by reason, at least in the way that he's talking about it here. It's guided by endless growth. And that's all it is. That's the only logic. It's just perpetual, endless growth, hoard everything up, get property or own every single river, every single bit of fresh water so that it can be packaged and sold to people for money. Like, the world we live in is the world where people are running around collecting apples to hoard. So, like, what sense can we make of what John Locke is saying here, given what we're seeing happen in the world now? But in any case, like, it's just hard not to acknowledge that, but if we didn't acknowledge the state of the capitalist economy today, or even during his own time, the point that he's making is that our attachment to the land is given to us by God, like apodictically. It's like in the Bible, God is like, go forth and prosper, work on the land, yada, yada, yada. And so he says that anyone who works on the land demonstrates industriousness and rationality that earns them the right to that land. And it gives them their sense of purposefulness. Purposefulness, whatever, in the world. So maybe this is why, like, and then his view of American colonialism was totally informed by this, where he just looked at what was going on in the Americas, and he was like, look, it's uninhabited, or the people there don't know how to actually work on the land. So you go and you work on the land, and then it's rightfully yours. Which is just to say that the only legitimate stake anyone has to any territory is if they work on it in the way that Europeans imagined it must be worked on. This completely throws out the window, like, other reasons land might be valuable beyond just economic ends, like for religious purpose, spiritual purpose, purposes, militarily strategic purposes, political purposes, so on. Like, and, you know, maybe land, even in our own world, can just mean nothing. It can just be a place where people like to go, and it's nice. Like, it's a very tragic thing that we need to have government departments that protect land. And they're like national parks, and, you know, what? Like, are we that close to the brink of destruction where we have to, like, set up these departments to protect, like, nice spots of land? Like, what a world. So for Locke, really what it comes down to is that labor sets people apart. And this ultimately explains why non-Europeans live, for him, a lesser existence than working-class Europeans, because they properly know how to work and work the land. Now, to return just briefly to the question of perishability, you know, the apples going bad, Locke celebrates the introduction of money to act as a universal equivalent, so, you know, I don't have to trade apples for like cows or whatever I trade apples for. I could have money that stands in for the apples, so the apple can stay on the tree and, you know, it won't go bad, and then we could do a deal. It's like, of course this was going to go wrong, but whatever. Maybe I'm a dirty communist or something. And that puts us here into chapter 6 of paternal power, or the power of parents over children. So we have to go back to Filmer for this briefly, where Filmer says that parents, but really the father, has like sovereign authority over their kids, which John Locke does not believe at all. Where he says that if we actually look at the Bible, it's both parents, firstly, that have power over their children, not just the father. And patriarchal power should then be understood as paternal power. Now, although Locke advocates for equality that is between men and women in raising their children within the heterosexual matrix, he doesn't think the same applies to children who are largely helpless. So parents for Locke don't just exert power over children just to, like, be powerful. He acknowledges that parents serve a very important role in teaching children how to, like, live. They're their teachers and they love them. Parents die for their children, not all the time, but often, demonstrating that love for them, and not how they don't just view their children as being these loyal subjects. And so in this way, parental power is a perfect template for him in understanding what government is meant to do. That is, government is meant to supply safety, like parents to children, and to guide people in their pursuit of knowledge and liberty. He thinks parents have the exact same goal. Parents should guide children to properly understand what it means to be free and what life they want to live and pursue, all while feeling safe, which is what government should do for Locke. Now, while he's like a little bit, you know, he acknowledges parental power should be split between men and women, he's still sexist and still thinks that men should have most of the power and be the primary guiders, whatever, of their children's lives. And that puts us here into chapter 7, the last one we'll cover, and then we'll stop after this and pick up from chapter 8 next time. Chapter 7 titled, Of Political or Civil Society. So as humans, we need to cooperate. If you've listened to me at all, the thing I love to repeat is that if we didn't work together as humans, we would be very screwed. If any of your ancestors at one point, thousands of years ago, were like, I don't actually like living in this community, I'm going to go off in the woods by myself, you would not be listening right now. No. You would have never existed. So be very thankful that your relatives were like, your ancestors thought, I better stay with the group. Like, Bill is really annoying me, but I think it'll be better if I stick around in the group here. But John Locke goes back even further to say that the first coordinated cooperation between people occurred between men and women in their mutual effort to raise children. And he says that this gave birth to then other possible dynamics, like between lord and servant, which is such a fantastical leap in logic that it's like, it's almost comical. Like, it's funny in the way that John Locke thought Filmer's arguments were funny, which is one of the real benefits of engaging with a thinker who is such, who is so rudely disgusted by another thinker's thought, because now I can apply the same rude disgust to John Locke. He could do it, so why couldn't I? I just can't believe this guy. Every time he's always criticizing. Why doesn't he just let John Locke be? Like, what did John Locke ever do to him? But the absurdity behind locating the primary cooperation between men and women, as between men and women and their ability to raise children, it is so absurd because that's not even the case today. Like, you know, even in America, if you just look at, like, how little cooperation there actually occurs between men and women in raising children, it's like, what? And then to extrapolate from that, that this first unity between men and women then set the stage for others between people of different classes, it's like, John, my guy, we've been humans for like 100,000 years, but we only started to develop like class-based hierarchies a few hundred years ago. It's like, how do you say that either of these things are born out of the other then? It's just wild. It's just wild. But for him, unlike other species, humans have to remain coupled, you know, okay. Humans have to remain coupled to raise their kids where the woman just reproduces and man provides. That's his vision, right? I mean, he's just guided by these sexist myths about the nature of human coupling. Now, like, of course he was a product of his time. Like, of course. But why couldn't the same be said of the guy he was criticizing before? So here we are back again. We're going to criticize Locke because he was criticizing Filmer. So he asked for it. But he says that to lend him an olive branch, he's clear that men should have no right over women or their bodies, which at the time, I'm sure, was a pretty radical thesis. Because he believes, like, fundamentally that women are people. Like, can you imagine? What a radical idea. And that therefore they should have the same right, autonomy over their body, as he believes men should. And he thinks that women should have the right to leave their man only after their child has grown up out of infancy. Because he thinks that in order for a child to be raised at all, apparently, to acquire any kind of knowledge, there has to be a man and a woman. Which is, like, again, look at our world. Like, okay, the men get home from work and play video games until bedtime, or like watching their sporting events or out with their friends. Meanwhile, the woman in heterosexual cisgender dynamic is like taking care of all the household duties, taking care of all the obligations, making sure everything's happening. And we're supposed to think that like humans are predisposed to living in these heterosexual couplings to properly raise children. What? Now, because he thinks or views this as being a natural dynamic between men and women, therefore the law should have no sway over this dynamic. And I mean, I kind of agree that the law and government should not be able to tell anyone who they can marry or how to properly conduct themselves in a relationship. Like, yeah, unless it means like there's physical violence being inflicted. Totally agree, I think. Now, he also considers cases where the family has other members in it, like servants, like butlers, but also enslaved people. And he uses these examples to say that in such a case, the parents don't have authoritarian power or monarchical power over these people, except in the case of enslaved people, of course, for Locke. And he's referring to those cases where these enslaved people or people were enslaved through war. So I guess that's the only kind of enslavement he's cool with. Good on you, Locke. What a hero. So the father and mother of him, they do not have monarchical power over these people. Right, just because they've been paid to do a job or something, the extent of that power stops there, really. They can't, parents can't actually choose whether or not these people die or not. Whereas when you read Filmer, it kind of seems that way. Filmer thinks that anyone working in the household under parental rule is then like, the parents could put them to death, potentially. So like in the family, John Locke is clear that within society, no one should have monarchical power, entire power over the whole of society. Where for him instead, civil society established its edicts and laws with the consent of the free people who willingly comprise that commonwealth, comprise that society. So people will naturally establish laws then that guarantee their freedom and protection of property. Therefore, what they earned through their labor, that is what is theirs. And it is the job of government to protect that and to keep people in safety and to adjudicate and deal with conflicts between people. So the society will set up courts and everything to have these figures be, neutral, objective agents acting, to best represent the people, to figure out the truth of any dynamic. Because if not, then you would just have a state of war where people are just battling it out amongst themselves without appealing to any neutral, ostensibly neutral, or objective third party or court. So for him, monarchies, any situation where there is a ruler that has absolute control over everything, he says this is just reminiscent of the state of war, almost the state of nature too, because laws are determined almost arbitrarily, where this monarch might get up in the morning and be like, God, I really hate baguette. I really hope I'm gonna legislate that there's no more baguette in this country anymore. Which would be a villainous thing to do. One of the worst in history, to get rid of baguette. But that would be just an arbitrary law that just reflects one dude's interest that one day, which is not conducive to a healthy civil society for John Locke. Now, you remember at the beginning when I was like, it kind of seems for Locke that the ruler exists above the law. Well, he's clear that that can't fully be the case. Where the ruler is somebody who's been established by consent, and the ruler could assume different forms, like a democratically elected republican government is what he's really advocating for, where there's checks and balances, where there's no leader has tyrannical power. But laws are set up in such a way that they happen then by the consent of the people and are acted upon by those in authority. So in that way, they have to kind of exist above the laws, and that they're going to be the primary determining factors, whether or not a bill becomes a law, at least in the States, or if a law even gets consecrated at all. So at the same time, they are above the law, but they have to, for Locke, always be attached to the people, so they aren't totally away from it. And yeah, let's wrap that one up there. Next time we're going to pick up from chapter 8 and go to the end of John Locke's Second Treatise of Government. Yeah, let me know what you think. Do you buy it? You agree with Locke? Why? Why not? If there's anything I got wrong, I'd love to hear about it. Anything I excluded, I'd love to hear about it. And yeah, on that note, take care.